Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hi everyone and welcome to Lush Tums the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today we are joined by registered nurse, midwife, author, NLP trainer and father of eight, Mark Harris, and grandfather of 12. Mark has been practicing midwifery since 1994 and developed an antenatal education program, Birthing for Blokes, aimed at preparing fathers-to-be to support their partner with confidence during pregnancy, birth and postnatally. In his award-winning book, Men, Love and Birth, he uses his experience and shares techniques to encourage men to be fully present and connected with their partner in the lead up to and during labour. I met Mark in 2018 through his work as an NLP trainer when I attended his birthing awareness training so I could become a practitioner of the three-step rewind technique and use it to support people who had experienced a traumatic birth or postnatal experience. His warm and enthusiastic teaching style and vast knowledge was totally inspiring. When Claire and I decided to do this podcast, he was at the top of my list to have as a guest, so I'm thrilled he said yes. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
So lovely to have you, Mark. I'm a big fan as well.
Cool. Thank you.
So when you trained as a student midwife, there were 61 male midwives out of 36,000 in the whole of the UK.
Yeah.
What drew you into training as a midwife?
Well, that's a really good question. My first wife and I, we had five children under six and a half with no twins. So life was quite manic. And as they were being born, I trained as a nurse in 88. And I found that once I trained, I was being pulled away from the bedside. Suddenly, I was responsible for drug rounds and writing care plans. And I really wasn't enjoying it. So, you know, coupled with quite a stressful home life, because we homeschooled those six children as well, I was getting really stressed. Now, around about this time, my late wife was diagnosed with cancer for the first time. So there were lots of kind of mental health related pressures on me. And one of my best friends who I trained with as a nurse rang me up one day and just said, Mark, you need to try midwifery. He was the first male midwife in Warwickshire. And he said, being a midwife means being with woman, he said. He said, you can't be a midwife without being with the person you're supporting. And on the back of that, I applied to do the midwifery training in Leicester, which was the first diploma in higher education back then. And yeah, that's what got me into it.
Wow.
What a lovely story. I'm literally blown away by the idea of having that many children being homeschooled all so young. How did you do it? My goodness.
Well, I worked a lot. That's how I did it. I was out of the house a lot. I think if my late wife was alive, she wouldn't recommend it. We were autonomous homeschoolers. So what would you call that now? Unschooling? I mean, we're talking 30 years ago, right? So we didn't actively teach our children anything. We allowed learning to evolve around their interests, which is a bit scary because Joe, my youngest biological son, we weren't even sure he could read when he was 14. So it's a bit scary. Well, it's a bit scary being that hands off, to be honest.
Did it all work out in the end?
Yeah. I mean, Joe went to college at 16 and got level 2 English and maths in a year. And Abigail, my youngest daughter, the first essay she ever wrote, bar none, was on an undergraduate psychology degree at Leicester University. So they've all done okay.
Brilliant, brilliant. You're pioneering nature at home and in the workplace. It just must thread across everything. That's so fascinating, Mark.
Well, in a way, needs must. You know, when my late wife died, there was me and these 5 children, some of them becoming teenagers, and the autonomous way of working just seemed to work. I mean, my little boys, when they were little, wanted to be midwives until they realised. And then when they realised, their friends would say, "What does your dad do for a living?" And they'd say, "Oh, nothing, he's unemployed."
So do you think it would be more beneficial if there were more male midwives?
No. I don't. You know, when I started in 91, I think it was, there were 61 midwives, like you said, out of 38,000. Now, today, as we speak, 48,000 midwives and about 221 men. So it hasn't really been a growth area, has it?
No.
And I think that's got something to do with how her neurophysiological systems evolve in distinct ways, whether we're male or female. I think there is something about the way the male of the species has evolved that makes him less likely to find the role rewarding. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And what about the role did you find rewarding?
Well, that's a really good question. I remember walking into the birth room. I'd already been at birth of some of my own children. And I remember watching a woman responding to the kind of ancient hormonal forces.
Mm.
And like a dance almost unfolding. It was like an ebbing and a flowing and a surging and a moving and a breathing that almost looked like it was orchestrated. And I remember being in awe. I remember being flabbergasted and thinking, I don't understand this. This is a mystery to me. And then I looked up and I looked around and I could see the fingerprint of a man upon the institution, a partogram, which was measuring a process that cannot be measured. You know, a partogram seeks to measure a narrative that won't yield to being measured. I saw a CTG machine, you know, a cardiotachograph machine, and I saw a man's best attempt to chart the process. And I was at a kind of a crossroads. I could either fall back on the testosterone-ridden environment and just feel comfortable in the pseudo sense of control and management, or I could just point to the source of birthing power inside a woman. I knew it was always going to be mysterious to me. I knew that. And I just chose to submit to the power of birthing women and to point to the source of birthing power, which is always inside a woman. And that was the path I took, really.
Wow, so beautifully put, Mark.
That sounds like a really standout moment for you, a real time of transformation.
Yeah, well, there was another point about 5 years after that. So I'd had that experience and I was learning anything I did that interrupted the kind of primeval dance of birth would slow the whole process down. So I learned to do vaginal examinations when they were indicated, which is very rarely. But anyway, I learned to do them in whatever position the woman chose to be in, so that I didn't interrupt the flow of the birthing dance. So I was making all these kinds of changes in my practice, and I was teased an awful lot by the core staff. I mean, Sister Holloway would give handover and she would say, "Room 16, Mark's on the bed, woman's on the floor." So there was a lot of teasing going on. And then I'd been qualified about 5 years, and I had a student called Maggie. And Maggie was about 42. She didn't have any children. And I was her mentor, which I loved being a mentor. You know, I loved teaching, and I loved not having to write as many notes and stuff like that. And I walked into the room with Maggie. Now, Maggie had never been in the birth room before as a professional. So we walked into the room, and I went to the back of the room, which was my practice, and I used to slide down the wall. I was 30 stone in those days, so it was difficult to become invisible when you're that big. So I used to go into the room and kind of slink down the back of the wall and start filling out notes, you know, after I'd said hello. So that's what I'm doing. And Maggie just comes in, and she comes alongside this woman. She'd never been in the birth room before, ever. She just comes alongside this woman, and she starts gently touching this woman. And it's almost like she joined the dance. And I'm sitting against the wall, and I'm starting to cry, and I'm doing it now. And I was crying with snot and everything, because what I was seeing was a woman being with woman, and I knew that I could not even touch the experience of another woman with a woman as she births. And that was a seminal moment for me. I knew that I was always doing my best, living inside a masculine neurophysiology, but that an intuitive woman would always be better. And I think that's another reason why I don't think midwifery is a growth area for a man. I really don't. Yeah, sorry about that.
Very, very poignant and very touching. And yeah, I completely resonate with everything you've just said.
I like how what you did though was you actively protected that space for her, which is something that often in a birthing room is the job of the partner, which is why your book is so key for fathers preparing for the birth of their child. And I think there is a real need now to find that space, that protection, that safety in that space, so that a woman can do the dance, because ultimately if it's not protected, she can't dance. And even if she has another woman with her, I mean, hopefully they can find a way to make it work. But like you said, that that space is very special, and I'm not sure how many people actually get to have that kind of experience.
But what's that phrase that Michel Odon says? He says that conception and birth are one event separated by time. You know, the idea that when a woman is sexually released, the hormones that are going to keep birth moving are the same hormones involved with that. Now, when a man gets to have insight into that physiological phenomena, he intuitively realizes that bright lights and strangers in the room are not going to be a good thing. Unless you're into dogging, I suppose. Yeah, but in the context of a normal kind of intimate relationship, the environment that the baby was conceived in is probably going to be close to the optimum environment that a baby will be born in.
So beautiful. Claire and I always describe that as it's completing the circle.
Yes, nice. Yeah, very nice.
I love in your book, you talk about using breath work and mantras and grounding techniques to help fathers to stay present and connected. Definitely some crossover with what we teach in yoga. Do you practice yoga at all?
I don't. I get influenced very much by Advaita Vedanta. Non-dual understanding of spirituality, so influenced by that, and have meditated Vipassana and stuff in the past. But you see, what led me to emphasize grounding techniques was an understanding. You see, we're very quick to say a woman is responding to ancient evolutionary forces when she births, right? So is a man. you know, in the context of birth, a man experiences an enormous shunt via the amygdala. You know, we know the amygdala is responsible for the four Fs, fight, flight, freeze, and reproduction. So we know that that part of his brain is working perfectly. When he's in a stressful situation, he feels like he wants to do something, but he feels powerless. What we see in the birth room is men responding in the context of their habitual patterns when it comes to a stress response. So they're trying to handle this enormous force, this enormous adrenaline shunt. And I've had men who sit in the corner watching their iPad. Are they arseholes? Maybe. But what's going on in terms of their physiology is the violence of this hormonal reaction is leading them to retreat from the stressor. You know, it's because that's their pattern of dealing with stress. And then I had another guy, we had to call the police because he headbutted a paediatrician. And we've all wanted to do that, frankly, you know, in the context of breastfeeding, but, you know. So what was he doing? He was responding to this hormonal pressure in the way that he responded to all kinds of stress in his life, which was to respond with aggression himself. So if men have no idea of how to ground themselves through breath work and body work, these hormonal kind of thrusts and drives will overpower them in the context of the birth room.
And what kind of effect do you see that kind of spilling out, you know, for the woman that's giving birth, seeing her partner retreating or having a big act of aggression? Does it tend to affect her, or is she in her zone?
Of course. You see that what I've seen again and again over the 28 odd years is that when a man isn't established, when a birth partner man isn't established in being present, the kind of space for birth to unfold in, when he isn't solidly present, a woman is inclined to want to mother him. Mm-hmm. And as she moves into mothering him, she moves out of that space that where she's losing herself, where her connection to the neocortex is being diminished. That's where we want her. We want her to lose herself. We want her to become more and more detached from the neocortex. Mm-hmm. And if she's mothering him, there's no space for her to do that.
She's thinking of other rather than releasing.
Thinking as well. As you said, we want her to be dancing, not thinking.
Yeah. We don't want to be answering questions.
So with your Birthing for Blokes program, have you had some amazing feedback from the dads afterwards as to, you know, some of the tools they've taken on board and how it's helped them, not only probably in the birth, but in life? These are life skills, learning to ground.
Well, I've had feedback from men who have said that the book actually salvaged their relationship. Mm-hmm. That they really hadn't understood what was intuitive to a female physiology. So the kind of light-hearted exercises like pick a job around the house that you can see needs doing, do it without being asked and without looking for praise. You know, it sounds obvious to a female neurophysiology. Stuff needs doing, you do it, right? And it needs doing regularly, right? But it seems that that isn't intuitively the case for a lot of men. So when they do that exercise and they notice the level of connection they're feeling with their partner goes up, mm-hmm. you know, that there's this sense in which their partner is pleased. They have an experience of creating a context where oxytocin is more likely to be flowing. You know, and quite frankly, you know, my wife's oxytocin needs to be flooding her. Otherwise, she's not even, you know, barely going to like me, let alone have sex. You know, but she knows this stuff. So when I'm putting out the rubbish, she looks at me, she said, there's still no chance.
You've got to dig a bit deeper now, Mark. You've set the bar.
I think as a man, you have to realise that if there's a point system for topping up oxytocin or creating a frame of reference where oxytocin is more likely to raise, my way of valuing an activity in terms of points is very different from my partner's. So if I buy 10 flowers, in my head, that's 10 oxytocin points, but it's barely one in her scheme of things. And of course, if I do the washing up once, that's done once. But if I don't establish a habit, you know, doing it when I see it needs doing, you know, that one-off event will soon be forgotten.
Yeah, it takes dedication to work on this oxytocin bank account.
Yeah, I have feedback from men probably 2 or 3 times a month. And all of that feedback is just so humbling. You know, people talking about having a really difficult first birth and then reading the book and finding that they chose to have a home birth where they wouldn't have even thought about it before. That kind of feedback is lovely. And since the program's been free, 3 people a week join up now. So it's reaching a much bigger audience. So I'm pleased about that.
So moving on to your work as a NLP trainer, for those who are not familiar with NLP or neuro-linguistic programming, could you explain what it is and what does an NLP practitioner do?
I mean, I was in the closet about NLP for about 15 years. I started learning NLP when my first wife was diagnosed with cancer for the first time. And I discovered it as a means to self-care. I kept quiet about it because I've been training in it and learning it and practicing it for a long, long time. I kept quiet. Because if you Google NLP, you'll find a lot of wackos and a lot of pseudoscience peddled in the name of NLP. And I just didn't want to associate myself with that. NLP actually comes from a very rich academic heritage. Alfred Korbitsky, who invented, if you like, general semantics. Gregory Bateson, who was the father of cybernetics and systems theory. And Noam Chomsky's transformational grammar are all the foundations of the model of neurolinguistic programming. I mean, neuro relates to our neurophysiological system. L is for linguistic, which is pointing to the essential foundational influence that language has on our behavior. Mm-hmm. And programming is just another way of talking about behavior. So it's how our neurophysiological system is influenced by our use of language. In a nutshell, I'd say that's what NLP is. I apply NLP very specifically. So the Birthing Awareness 2-day training program teaches people the Birthing Awareness 3-step process, which is not therapy, and I'm not a therapist. It's a process which, when a client is led through in a kind of a guided meditation type way, leads to a re-encoding of the memory that has been causing her suffering until now, so that the memory can be kind of like detached from the amygdala. So she gets to keep all the wisdom and understanding that the experience has brought to bear upon her life, but without the suffering. So I train that pretty much. It's my full-time occupation at the minute.
So your work as a midwife was about supporting and empowering people to hopefully have a positive experience. And the work you do now is about helping those who have not had a positive experience. What drew you into changing your work so that you were working around trauma?
Life stage would be one thing. If you think, the Birth Trauma Association 4 years ago said 200,000 women a year describe their birth as traumatic. 200,000 women a year. And that's 4 years ago. 5% of those women will go on to receive a diagnosis of PTSD or complex PTSD. So that 5% will then go forward for whatever treatment is available. And they'll have to wait for ages. So that's a massive number of women and their partners who are suffering as a result of a birth experience. And the process that I teach over 2 days, which is not therapy, and we aren't therapists. We don't offer advice. We don't offer insight. We don't deal with the client's meaning making. In fact, the client doesn't even have to tell us about their experience. The fact that it's so simple to teach and use, I just decided that it was a good focus for the rest of my working life. Those years spent working will have been worthwhile focusing there.
Having used the process myself with several people now and seeing what a profound difference it can make on their whole lives. I mean, yeah. It's not just someone suffering from difficult emotions, feelings, flashbacks. It affects how they live their life on a day-to-day basis. It affects how they parent. It affects the choices they make. And being able to support them to separate those emotions away from the memory of the experience really is transformational. And I was blown away how, when I used it for the first time with someone, how I noticed their whole body language changed in a space of 40 minutes, how they just suddenly seemed so much more relaxed, and the muscles around their face and their shoulders. And it was like they'd reclaimed a bit of themselves. And it made me really passionate about using it to support more people.
Yeah, I mean, often women will say they feel lighter. Or now, we've been collecting data electronically for about 2 and a bit years. Students do 2 case studies, and the case study clients commit to offering anonymous feedback via a survey link. And we've been collecting data, like I say, for 2 years. We've got 261 replies. And this isn't research, at best it's audit. Every single one, 100% of respondents have said the process has affected their lives in a positive way. Not one detractor. And that gives me confidence, really, you know, that the process is having an effect.
Not even that it's neutral or made no difference, it's that it's positive. What insights has your work given you? 30% of parents describe their birth experience as traumatic. And in your opinion, why do you think the number is so high? And do you think it can be changed?
Yes, I do. I think trauma, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. So there is a sense in which there is no such thing as trauma. You know, I looked after 2 women not long after I qualified, and they both gave birth in the same week. They both gave birth in the home from home. They both had dim lights. They both gave birth in a pool. They both had music playing. They both were the first people to touch their baby. They both had a physiological third stage underwater. And I remember that because it was controversial back then. One of them went on to talk about their birth as being a transformational life experience. And the other one, I remember her name, Sally, went on to have what you would call full-blown PTSD symptomology from that experience. You know, if you looked at it on a video, you'd say they were the same. So that shows me that Shakespeare said it in Hamlet. He said, things are neither good nor bad, but thinking make them so. Mm-hmm. You know, men and women are living inside the experience of the story they tell themselves about what happened. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
Having said that, I think our environments sometimes contribute towards a woman having an experience which is less than optimal. You know, women often say, I felt out of control. I felt that my opinions were not valued. You know, my privacy was not respected. I don't feel like I was really given informed consent. I feel like I was rushed in the second stage of my birthing process. all of those things are artifacts of the institution. And it would be wrong of us if we said that that kind of behaviour, those kind of systems are not contributing to women describing their experience as traumatic. They do. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no doubt about it. So I think it's a mixture of both. It's a mixture of women realizing that meaning making is an inside job. Mm-hmm. And the only person who has power over that is the woman herself. And then it's a question, I think, of our birthing institutions being completely overhauled and being led by female leadership. But really at the top, I'm not just talking about senior midwives. I'm talking about medical directors, so-called, being thoroughly led by women.
That is a really powerful and inspiring statement, Mark. Thank you. And we can see how beneficial that would be in the birth space and in the context of what we're talking about.
The feminine force can crush the male essence very easily, which is why I think masculine energy down the senses has been so intimidated by feminine power. And, you know, we've always had a choice. We either seek to create the illusion of control, or we worship and surrender. And that's the path I took in the context of birth and in my relationship.
I think it's also interesting that the idea of having more women at the top of the system makers and changers, and but it's not necessarily even a male female thing. It's that way of thinking, and like you said, the you know, I think as a society we feel safer with the idea of being able to measure or having this illusion of control. And how do we shift that thinking to one where we are able to trust and surrender? And this is something we do all the time in the mat and yoga, and then try and take it off of the mat with us as well. And I wonder what you think about how that might start to happen. How do you think things will change so that the intuitive nature of birth and of wellness and our experience as a human might be given the same credence and validity as the more empirical measurements?
It does transcend physical characteristics when we talk about it in these terms. But if I was going to be very specific and action orientated, how are we going to transform birthing institutions which are impregnated with a masculine way of seeing the world? Well, I don't think we're going to do it top down. I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime at all. I think we're far more likely in the society that we're in, with YouTube, Instagram, with the democratization of publishing and all that kind of stuff, I think it's going to happen from the grassroots. You know, it's going to be grassroots groups of women that campaign, that get onto maternity liaison committees, that kind of stir things up at the base. Because I think our leadership within the institutions are afraid of change. And that makes sense, because they've been used to reproducing patterns for a long time that have worked inside certain parameters. And the idea of transformation is very scary. So all we get is tweaking of the edges, when what we actually need is a grass and roots revolution. So I think it's only going to happen through pressure groups from the ground up. That's why I was really disappointed that the positive birth movement stopped being directed by Millie. I understand why, you know, why she's done that. But things like positive birth movement. Having said that, we do underestimate the progress we've made, right? I was training someone yesterday with Zoom. I can train all over the world now. So I was training someone in America yesterday. And she was saying that in Louisiana, in her state, having a vaginal birth after a cesarean section with the first child is illegal.
Wow.
So it does open your eyes a bit, doesn't it?
I think we're in a bit of a bubble. Where I'm based in Brighton, we have an amazing community of birth workers and midwives. We've ended up with a home birth rate that's hit 10% at time to time, where the rest of the country's about 2%. And I feel like I'm in a bit of a birth bubble here where things are really progressive.
In Portugal, I was at the first woman-driven birth conference a number of years ago, and water birth was illegal.
And I think when we look at things like that that are happening around the world, one quote that I remember Robin Grill mentioned, he wrote Parenting for a Peaceful World. He was saying the birth space is the last bastion of misogyny.
Without a doubt. You know, when we think about long COVID, right, you know, we've got a massive potential number of people that are going to suffer from long COVID, you know, which is the carrying on of symptoms over a longer period, which resembles very much fibromyalgia, ME type symptoms. You see, I think what we're going to see is loads of men are going to be affected by long COVID, which will lead to lots of work being done in fibromyalgia and ME, which has traditionally been predominantly women that suffer from it. Whenever men start suffering from stuff, stuff happens.
It's worth funding the research then, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. I think women have suffered under the tyranny of the patriarchy for about 2,000 years. And we are ready for a change.
And I feel there's like a tsunami happening, having been working in pregnancy yoga and antenatal education for the last 15 years. I felt back then I was like banging a little drum, trying to promote empowerment and informed choice and all of that stuff. And, you know, you can make your experience positive. Let's look at reframing. Let's look at these processes that you were talking so brilliantly about. And now I feel like there's a huge tsunami of amazing conversation happening about birth and periods and menopause and, you know, the Me Too campaign and all of it. It's brilliant. Like, things are changing.
So, Mark, we do a question that we ask all our guests, is we offer the statement, I'm a yoga teacher, but, and it's where we share things that perhaps don't fit in with the perception of what a yoga teacher should be.
Okay.
So for you, perhaps you could say I'm a midwife or I'm an NLP practitioner or whatever other label you want to go for, and perhaps dispel some myths associated with that title.
So I'm father of eight, grandfather of 12, and I definitely like my grandchildren more than my first children. I mean, that's not a joke. I do. I mean, I love them all. But if I could have had my grandchildren first, and I think that's got something to do with how, with my biological children, I made their behaviour mean something about my parenting.
Yeah.
So when I saw them behave, it was filtered through the lens of this is going to reflect on me as a parent. Yeah, when I see the grandchildren, it's just funny. It's just endearing. Things that I would have been pulling my hair out at, suddenly I watch it and I think, oh, this is that's cool.
And this is exactly why we need our grandfathers and grandmothers' wisdoms to show us parents that we can hold it all a bit more lightly. I'm a yoga teacher, but... I actually haven't rolled my mat out this week at all for any self-practice, and naughty, naughty me, little slap on the wrist. The mat hasn't been out, but I feel like I have been doing my yoga in other ways off the mat, and how I've been thinking about things and calming myself down and self-regulation. I've been doing yoga as a way of life, but I definitely haven't been doing it on the mat. Sorry, everyone.
So I'm a yoga teacher, but I am not a morning person. The many times I've tried to wake up and do a meditation first thing in the morning, I end up sleeping, sat up. and I come round with the singing bell on my app at the end, and I realise I've just been asleep, sat there, not meditating at all. So I am not a morning person. We also like to ask, what are you grateful for in your life right now?
I think I'm particularly grateful for my adopted son, Darice, who's 12. And we just started homeschooling him because he was in the school system. And since COVID, we just decided now we're going to do it. And, you know, he didn't have a great start in life. And I'm very grateful that we have him in our lives. You know, some people say, oh, what a sacrifice, you know, fostering and adopting. It's ridiculous. The payoffs in terms of personal reward are massive. I mean, if you'd have told me it was possible to love, you know, an adopted son as much as you love your biological children, I'd have been suspicious. But now I know beyond doubt it's possible. So I'm immensely grateful for all the richness he's brought to my life.
Beautiful and inspiring. Thank you, Mark.
What are you grateful for in your life right now, Claire?
Well, I'm very grateful for Mark coming on our podcast and being such a fountain of wisdom and so generous with sharing your you know, your learnings and your experiences. It's been a real pleasure to sit and listen to you, Mark, and I really hope we get a chance to do this again.
I was going to say the same thing, so ditto. And our last question is that we believe each baby or pregnancy brings a gift, maybe a quality or a personality trait you didn't have before. Do you agree? And what gifts did your babies bring you? Or maybe your wife?
Or maybe your grandchildren?
My grandchildren's very easy to connect with because they open my eyes to how much play. It's play is just central to a child's life. And I think, when did I stop approaching life in that way? Because everything can be done playfully. Making money, writing, teaching, training. Why did I stop relating to my experiences like they were play? So my grandchildren teach me that. To be playful, curious, unafraid of it, innovating in any way that's fun.
I love that. I've come across that a couple of times, and it's as a grown-up and a parent, I try and practice it like as a thing, like, can I be more playful in these situations? And actually it's really hard. I find it really hard to let go of my stuff and just get on and have a laugh and a play.
Yeah, I remember Marshall Rosenberg saying that he never worked for money. And what he meant was, obviously, he made a request that people pay him if they got value out of what he did. But he never worked with an eye to earning money from what he did. He wanted to do work that he felt was rewarding and challenging and playful and inquisitive. And hopefully people will pay him for doing that.
Mm.
But I like that attitude. No, I'm not going to work for money only. Never. And that's the way I feel now. Maybe easier when you're 57 and your house is paid off. You know, maybe easier to do it then. But I like that kind of orientation on doing work that you value. And then if people pay you for doing it, great.
Yeah, I definitely align with that sentiment. And I feel like since I've embarked on my yoga teaching and pregnancy yoga teaching journey, I don't feel like I've worked a day in my life. I mean, I work every hour under the sun, but actually I love it. It's a joy.
Yeah. I remember my young boy, Ben, my second oldest, he was signed for Derby football club. And when my wife died, he was offered a 2-year contract, which would have taken him to scholarship, but he packed up playing football completely. And I remember him saying to me once, find a job you love, Dad, and you retire the day you find it. And I thought, yeah, you're right. If you love what you do, it doesn't occur to you as work, does it?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, anyone interested in training as a pregnancy yoga teacher, Claire and I might be able to help you with that. So do come and have a look on our website. Or perhaps you're interested in learning more about the three-step rewind, and maybe you'd be interested in doing some training with Mark, which I can highly recommend.
Yeah, it's a good time to do it now. I've limited the groups. There's only 4 students per group now. So the intimacy and the depth of learning, I think, goes even deeper.
Is it online at the moment, Mark?
Yeah, I've no plans to change. I like being online. And if I don't know when this is going out, but if people book before the end of May, if they use thank you 321 exclamation mark, capital T, they save £95. They can book for any date throughout the year, so long as they book before the end of May.
Brilliant. I will be signing up probably before the weekend is out.
Lovely. You're welcome.
Just want to thank you, Mark. That was amazing. So lovely to meet you and put a face to the name.
Thanks, Mark, so much. You've been absolutely amazing, and I've learned so much.
I've enjoyed it.